Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna on News Talk.
Yes, you can email the show aliveandkicking@newstalk.com or you'll find me on Twitter and Instagram. I'm at Claire McKenna Presents. Coming up this morning, the reality of caring for a loved one with dementia, missing them when they are still with you. I'll be chatting to Matt about his wife, Helena. They both appear in a new film, Don't Forget to Remember. I'll also be joined by life coach Mark Fennell to talk about how fulfillment is the best goal to aim for, and psychotherapist and burnout specialist Siobhan Murray on her later in life ADHD and autism diagnosis. So what kind of a health and wellness week did I have? Well, it's been a busy week this week. I've been in News Talk every day covering Lunchtime Live, so that's been nice. My first radio job was on a lunchtime talk show. I did that for 5 years, and it too was based around getting calls and texts from listeners on the day's topic. So while I'm only keeping the seat warm for Andrea while she celebrates her birthday week, I do feel very much at home in that role. And it's nice to be back on that style of show. I have been freelance, though, for over 10 years. And every week is different for me. I have a few regular slots, of course, like this beloved show. But I have found it strange to be in the same place for the same hours every day for a week. It's different. It is nice, though, that it has reminded me and given me a renewed sense of gratitude for the life that I do have, because often we take these sort of things for granted. I certainly do. Working for myself, though, I do sometimes miss being in a team, and I have enjoyed that. We've had some great belly laughs in the meetings. So a busy but a good week. And I will confess, as my busyness has gone up this week, as someone who's always talking about the importance of movement and meditation and they being the cornerstone to my well-being, I have found with a fuller schedule this week, it has been much, much harder. Meditations have been much shorter. The gym has been replaced with parking the car a little bit further away to just walk a little bit more. But look, as I always say, life ebbs and flows and you just have to go with it sometimes. And a quick thank you to everyone who came to the Reset Retreat in Kilkenny last weekend. I met a gorgeous bunch, loved hiking, yoga-ing, resetting and sauna and dipping with them all. I told them they'd get a shout out today. So that is it. Hello. You can email the show aliveandkicking@newstalk.com. Now, life coach Mark Fennell has given thousands of clients the tools they need to shift their thinking, unlock inner strength and find the motivation required to break through the feeling of being stuck so they can move forward and make lasting life changes. His book Breakthrough was a bestseller, and he has an event coming up in November called Soar. He joins me in studio now. Mark, you're very welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Now, you came on the show a little while back. We spoke about an amazing BBC documentary and podcast series looking at the areas of life coach, and it was a very nefarious story.
And the cults that are in the world. Yeah, crazy stuff.
But you're not involved.
No, I was on it for the right reasons. I was on it because they wanted to know what is the right practice, what's the wrong practice, and what is a life coach and what is deemed okay. So I was on there as that advisory capacity. And they also got me doing coaching with them and stuff so they could really envelop it and see what they were doing. But yeah, it was a fantastic experience, but eye-opening as well. You know, I suppose like any sector, any business, any place you go, there's always going to be a few bad apples. And unfortunately, when people are at an all-time low, they're searching, they're seeking. And sadly, some people will exploit that fact. So it was nice to do a lot. I suppose it was very rewarding because you knew you were doing a lot of good. And ultimately, the cult they went after got shut down. So it was went to the magistrates' courts in London and everything. So it really went... It was a big deal, but it was great to be part of it. And the podcast made top 10 globally, so it was pretty epic stuff. So, yeah,
amazing. And since then, you've gone on to have a best-selling book.
Yeah, I mean, nothing connected to that, but I was writing a book midstream, and the book Breakthrough, yeah, it came out there a couple of months ago. It's now on Audible as well. And it was basically a book about the story of a lot of people, you know, they know, may not sign up that they want a life coach, but they know they want to make things best and be the best they can be in life. And why not? You know, why not set your bar high? So I wanted to give a book that gets people started in the right direction when it comes to mindset, when it comes to self-esteem, self-belief, and having kind of a future focus for themselves and believing in themselves. So I said, if we have a book like that, I can only take so many people one-to-ones. I can only, you know, so many people, should we say, there's only so many life coaches in the world. I said, let's give someone almost like a manual. This will get you going. It's easy, accessible to anyone and everyone. And so the book Breakthrough was kind of born, and it's born out of real life stories. So it's an enjoyable read that way. And it's very relatable and it's very practical. It's like, you know what, if you need a breakthrough or you just want to, you're feeling stuck in life, that's where the book was born. And yeah, it's great. It did so well. So I'm delighted with it because it's like my baby, you know, kind of way. So it's cool.
Yeah, I loved it. And it reads really well because sometimes, now I read a lot of books like this for work and for myself. So I'm kind of well used to them. And yeah, sometimes I know at the end of a day, you're like, I don't want to work on myself before I go to sleep at night. But this reads really well. You've got lots of personal anecdotes, client stories, and then a little bit of advice weaved in. And it deals a lot with this idea of being stuck. Talk to me a little bit about what gets people stuck.
Yeah, I think we all at times will find ourselves maybe stuck, you know, and it can be just from whatever reason. We're going through life, you know, navigating things, but yet we feel a little bit like the hamster on a wheel. We're going through life, but where are we going to? And what's it all kind of for, you know? And I don't mean it in a deep sense, but sometimes you'll find someone who's going through their life, tipping along, and they feel like, I just feel there should be more to me, more to life, more that I'm doing. It's the same kind of routine, a little bit mundane, you know, work during the week and weekends off, or navigating the kids or whatever it might be, but we have just life. And so a lot of us can feel stuck for that reason. People can also get stuck because travesties and things can happen in their life, but a lot of people feel just kind of the hamster on a wheel. And when they kind of zoom out and take a look at their life, they realize, do you know what? It's the same old, but what's it all about? Like, there must be more to life. I want things that excite me, energize me, and so forth. So the book very much talks about how you see yourself, you know, that inner identity. And the real piece around it is that for a lot of us, we live life reactively. We're just reacting to what shouts the loudest, what needs to be done first. And we go through most days in a reactive state. But the book kind of gets you to gear towards being more proactive in life and saying, you know, these are the things, responsibilities, the things that are maintenance in life, all relevant, all important. But let's just make sure that we have a direction, that life is giving us a thing that you cannot buy, that you cannot get anywhere. And that thing is called fulfillment. And having that fulfillment is what really drives people on. And I know it can be many different things. People can be stuck in their heads, just, I'm an overthinker, I'm a people pleaser, I'm a perfectionist, or, you know, I'm just literally all the time in my head, fearing the worst with anxiety or whatever it might be. And we can get stuck in that state when we're there for a long time. And it's kind of just coming up for air and going, hang on a minute, there is a lot more to life. And there's also a lot more potential to people than they ever realize. This is the, look, I'm doing a 22 years, I was told the other day, it's 22 years since I did my first talk, which is a long time. And I know I don't look it, Claire, don't say it, but I know I don't look it. I'm joking.
That's because you're so fulfilled. This is what fulfillment looks like.
I'm trying to self-encouragement here. But no, you know what it is? I've realized that it doesn't matter who the person is, you know, whether you're the stay-at-home parent, the CEO, and I get to meet a lot of interesting and amazing people. But there's one thing that I see is that everyone is seeking out fulfillment, and most people never tap into their actual level of potential. And I don't mean potential from a work ethic, but I mean potential as how they see themselves, see life, and I suppose getting the right priorities in play. And how that can look is amazing. For us, we went through a difficult time because we weren't able, we did everything we possibly could, we weren't able to have children. And I came to a place, it was a difficult, dark time, as you can imagine. But I remember feeling stuck because I said, will I ever be able to be happy again? Will I, like the simple things, will we ever be able to feel we don't have a sense of loss? Because you go through that period of grief. Will we ever be able to have life again fulfilled? So I learned through my own experience that you can, even through something that's so horrendous and something that you really, really wanted. And what I discovered was if you can have it in such dire circumstance and you can have it whenever you feel stuck in whatever you might get stuck in, the point was I saw everyone can get unstuck. And sometimes we're a little bit stuck and we don't even realize it. And so I figured out, I suppose, if I put it like this, the tools and the practical steps we can all do to literally kind of level up that sense of fulfillment. And I never thought I'd get to a place of feeling fulfilled in life, not having children. I love kids. We always would have wanted kids. We don't have kids. But as we were able to get both, and Fiona would agree, to a place of fulfillment again. And I think that's the benchmark. And it's one of the things that a lot of people over the years, and it's one of the things I was talking to you briefly about, a lot of people feel sometimes stuck that their life is going along. Their weight, for example, is a big thing. And this is a program I'm bringing around that's we've been running and has huge success. Because I always say sometimes if people are stuck with bad habits or things that they want to break free of, cravings, emotional eating and so forth. And what I realized, what I learned through finding fulfillment again. What I've learned from working with people over the 20 years was that a big area that a lot of people have, should we say, struggled with was things like their weight or like these bad habits that they can't shake off and so forth. So I put together this program to help people shift away from that. But it doesn't look at the food. It doesn't look at exercise. It starts where everything starts and ends, mindset. That's the key.
Yeah, because you sent me a voice note. We know each other. We've worked a couple of events together. And I have spoken about weight loss on the show for the last few weeks. And as I said on the show and on social media, I do tend to veer away from it because I believe in health at every size and a healthy relationship with food and body. But I did think there were stories to be told there. Yeah. And it can be a symptom of a massive transformation for people in how they feel about themselves and healthier habits that they take on, which is why I did it. So you sent me a voice note about self-worth and identity and how key they are as a foundation for any sort of health change.
100%. And this is the whole thing. See, so many people will focus. Many years ago, I struggled with anxiety chronically and I got over it, got out of it and never struggled with it again, thank God. Normal anxieties, but was able to. Through that and through what we learned myself from the children. So I know, not being able to have the kids, I've seen myself in the struggles and what you can do when there's something you just cannot change and how do you change it. And working with people over the years, what I saw was when you work on that identity piece, I wasn't talking to them about their food or anything. Naturally, they started to eat better. They started to move a little bit more. They started to do things and they were starting to get back in shape and so forth. I was talking about mindset. I was talking about inner self-worth and identity. Nothing to do with the exterior and how they looked. But naturally, when you start to find, should we say, find who you really are from within, it starts to reflect outside. And I always say to people, when we run the weight wellness study, the program, when we run it, I say, I'm not concerned about the numbers on the scales. And people go, but this is a weight loss program. No, no, I'm more concerned on how you view yourself from within. Because I know when that lines up, you will love life again. And things will organically, you'll want to start fixing them. People say, oh, are you going to motivate me because I really struggle to lose weight? And I say, listen, you do the program. It will come from within. It will come organically and naturally. Because it all goes down to that self-worth. And that's internal. That's how we see ourselves. And when I say identity, it's how you see yourself. Do you see yourself as, oh, I'll always be this way or I'll always struggle? Because how we see ourselves is how we end up. Where we focus is where we go. How we speak to ourselves will ultimately reflect in our life. I'm always busy. I'm always stressed. Oh, never enough time. That will become your reality and you'll maintain that reality. So it's not just about changing the words. It's changing how we see ourselves. Because most people say, well, is that visualization now? Is that what you're talking about? And I say, well, let me tell you like this. Every one of us are visualizing our day, our future week, our future month and our future selves. We're always visualizing whether we realize it or not. But is that image, is that how we see ourselves, one that serves us or one that helps us or is it one that hinders us? And for most people, reaching for the food, it's not the food. It's not even that they're hungry. It's not even the craving. There's an emotional thing going on. There's a psychological thing going on. And there's even a biological thing going on. It's proven that there's parts of the brain, the basal ganglia, you know, the reticular activation system. We physically get addicted. You know, there's chemical dopamine addictions happen. So you got to deconstruct that, the thinking patterns, how you see yourself, and watch how it'll start to impact everything you do, including what you eat.
And that's one of the reasons I want to talk about it as well, because a lot of that can be caught up in the societal expectations and the stigma and the shame and all of the things that contribute to somebody's self-worth being low. And the more we talk about things, the more we're likely to shift that a little bit and help others on the journey.
Yeah.
And you opened the book actually with a really interesting story of going for a pint with your dad.
We were going for lunch. He doesn't drink. But we were going to the pub.
Okay.
So to get bar food, right? So what happened was we went in. Yeah, it's a great story and it's kind of like just kicked it off. We went in and we saw, where my dad grew up in Dunleary. And we went to this bar because they do nice food. And we went in and he said, the guys were saying hello to him. He says, oh, they're guys I know for years, sitting at the end of the bar. And we had our lunch and whatever else. He said goodbye. And when he said hello to him, he says, oh, same old. They, you know, whatever. And there's a TV on in the corner and they're just kind of watching whatever was on that. And we left. And my dad came out. He says, I can't believe it. Those guys, I know them since we're teenagers, since we're kids. He said, and they sit at that bar and have sat at that bar. He said, as long as I remember, decades, you know, sitting at the end of a bar, telling people who will ever listen their problems, what's wrong with the world, what's wrong with the government, what's wrong with their life, all sorts. And he said, and they've all gone through stuff. like we all have, right? And what struck me was, I said, they're in that place of, you know, BSE, blame someone else, blame everyone else. They've gone through tough times. And it wasn't fair what happened to a lot of them. But the reality was, how you respond is the key. Do you stay there? Do you get bitter or do you get better, kind of thing? And what it struck me was, I said, they're stuck. I said, I never want to be the person at the end of the bar that uses my past as an excuse to be bitter. And I knew where that was, because I said, I could easily get upset because things didn't work out for us or whatever. You know, and I said, I can't let that define me. And I remember just going, that's so sad how many people are sitting in a place with all that potential never tapped into because of what's happened to them in their past. And their past literally is living on them like it's their present. And I talk about in the book about, we all have been victims of stuff, some horrendous things, some not so horrendous, but things that weren't fair. But how we see ourselves, do we see ourselves still like that victim? We were a victim then, but do we see ourselves still like a victim now, or do we see ourselves like a victor? And so many people reach for the drink, reach for the food, reach for the thing because they're trying to anesthetize or just escape for that moment of that dopamine hit, like the gambler or the drug addict. So many people. But when you really tap into inside and say, do you know what? No, I was a victim then, but I'm not a victim now. I remember my granny when she had breast cancer diagnosed and she'd only so long. And she said, you know, cancer's a part of my life, but it's not who I am. Because if I start thinking like a cancer victim, she said, and nothing wrong with that. She said, but if I start thinking that way, I'll start to just give up on everything. She said, I'm going to read as long as I can read, watch and listen to the news and the TV shows and radio shows as long as I can. She goes, cancer's a part of my life and one day it may take my life, but she said, I'm not going to let it define me now while I can still do things for me. And I said, that's amazing, because she was literally within 9 months, she was gone. And I think for many of us, it's how we see ourselves. It doesn't delete the past, and it's not about being naive or being this kind of fluffy, everything is awesome, positive approach. It's about going, do you see yourself as a victor or a victim? Do you see yourself that may have happened in your past, but is that defining who you are now? Or who are you now? And where do you want to go? And so what I do in the book and in the program, I help people go, so who are you now? How are you now? And what needs to change? And what if, in a matter of time, we could get you thinking like, all those things are in my past now, but the present is exciting and the future really makes me get, should we say, a motivation of enthusiasm. That's what life's all about. That's really what it is. And that's why I say, are you victor or victim? Because at the end of the day, no one can make that decision but you. And how we see ourselves will become a reality.
And that was even a light bulb moment for me, because I think when we think of life coaches and we think of becoming unstuck, we start focusing on achievement.
Yeah.
And, you know, get up off that bar stool and get out and set up the next .com, you know, become the CEO of a multi-million conglomerate. And that's not really what life is all about, because people get there and they're still unfulfilled.
Yeah.
It's just about having that sense of self-worth, that sense of identity and being able to be in the present, and that growth, I suppose, that evolution of yourself and learning as you go.
And most people don't realize that my thoughts are very powerful. You know, what you think is very powerful. You know, what you think, how you think, what you say to yourself, all will define a trajectory. Either it's going to be helpful or hinder you. We all have the inner critic, the imposter syndrome. We all have that self-doubt. It exists because our brain is geared to find out what's, should we say, wrong or what's to worry about or what feels like a threat to us. Our brain is geared that way. But through consistency and through the tools that I do share, you can start to shift that mindset. And I'm coming at a place of, I worked with a psychologist many years ago because she saw that I'd gotten out of the anxiety without medication and so forth. I'm not against medication, but for me, it just wasn't working out. So I never went down that road. And I still to this day work with her, a psychiatric nurse as well. And they send me patients who are struggling with, you know, severe things like depression, anxiety and so forth. And the results we've had when I start going, talking about identity with them. And when I say the word identity, people go, what's that? You know what I mean? What exactly? How do you unbox that? And I start saying, well, are you happy? And I say, out of 10. And I say, right, we'll start with that. Now I ask them, now are you fulfilled? Because we all think happiness is fulfillment. They're not. Happiness comes and goes. It's an emotion. Fulfillment is a state. And I say, are you fulfilled in what you do? And they go, no, I have no fulfillment. And I said, well, what if we could get you fulfilled? And so I start working with them on the fulfillment piece. And then naturally they get stronger, self-esteem comes in and they start to step out and want to get out of bed in the morning, want to face up to things and want to start pursuing how they see themselves as a victor of things, not a victim of things. And what I'm saying is I've seen people in the most chronic situations, the most, you know, and not so chronic, just people feeling stuck, you know, whether it's weight, whether it's bad habits. I worked with a guy, I shared this really quickly. he sold a company for a lot of money. His kids' kids will never have to work again, right? We're talking hundreds of millions now. Extremely wealthy guy. He lives now in Marbella and so forth and travels the world in his yachts. Anyway, mega story. Quite well known. He came to me for life coaching. And he said, because I worked with other colleagues that he knew. And he said, I've no purpose now because the company I built is gone. He said, making money is, I've more money than I can ever, you know, do anything with. But he said, what's making me fulfilled? What's the sense of purpose? So even a lot of people think my purpose is to make money. Well, I'm talking to people who've been there, done that, and have buckets of it, and they're still looking for purpose and fulfillment. And I had to work with him on that. So I'm saying we all need a level of purpose and fulfillment as a human being, and money is not it. And accolades are, like you said, are not it either.
Tell me about your event, SOAR, coming up in November.
Yes, thanks for that. Yes, November. So SOAR is talking about what we've talked about, but it's going to be a day for people who just going to, you know what, maybe if you're sitting on the fence going, I'd like to make things better for my life or for me, just don't know how. I'd like to have an enthusiasm to some degree about life. I want to kind of level up. Give me some practical advice. It's going to be a day of very much motivation. It's going to be a day of, if everyone knows me, I'm very practical. And it's going to be a day of that. It's in the Royal Marine, November 17th. Tickets are, actually early bird tickets are now on sale, if you don't mind me saying that. But please do come along. It is a day that will, I believe, I ran it before, something similar. And it was a day that, as many people said, became their day one. It became their day one of, okay, I can do this. This is actionable. I don't need, you know, to be, I'm not fluffy. You know what I mean? I'm not going to give you stuff that sounds all great, but isn't really true. I'm going to give you what I actually know works.
And we all know what we need. It's all in there. We just sometimes need a little bit of help,
the right questions.
You know, to get it out there and to get on the road. Where can people find you?
So the website, markfennell.ie. Instagram is probably the best place, markfennell.ie. And for the other program, weightwellness.ie. Tickets are on there and spaces are on there. And it all kicks off very soon. Exciting.
Keep doing what you're doing, Mark. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Alive and kicking on News Talk.
Now, burnout is something that many of us will experience at some point in our lifetimes. But for people who may not be neurotypical, the kinds of things that might lead to burnout might be completely lost on those around them. Siobhan Murray, psychotherapist specialising in burnout management and ADHD, joins me in studio now. Siobhan, you're very welcome back.
Oh, thank you so much. And talking about one of my favourite subjects.
And you have come on the show to talk about burnout. Twisting the Jar is your book. And this, your work has taken a bit of a turn since you had your own personal diagnosis.
Yeah, I think, so I'm 54, 55 in a month. And I would have always alluded to jokingly, oh, that's my ADHD. I would have been the dreamer in school. I wasn't. When we think of ADHD, we think of the hyper, you know, bouncing off walls and very reckless behaviour. Only 3% of the world's population who are diagnosed with ADHD will be externally hyper. That what very typical perception that we have. The rest of us will have the hyper, but it's generally a hyper mind. The overthinking, the ruminating, the negative thought spirals that can come with that, which then in its own way leads to self-doubt, self-criticism, ultimately can lead to levels of depression, to antisocial, as in not violent antisocial, but not wanting to be social because we don't trust ourselves, because we don't have that belief that we're just a good person, and especially within the undiagnosed. So I was never hyper. I would have been much more staring out the window. In class and school, I would have heard blah, 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 blah. So I wasn't engaged. Back then, nobody went, okay, what's going on? You were just, could work harder, could pay more attention, might have been a bit giddy, you know, all those very typical. I think lots of people can identify with those little school reports coming back, you know, a great person, but could do better. I left school early. I ran away, actually. I mean, that sounds like I left with a plan, but I didn't. I went to school one day in my uniform. God love my poor mother. Early on in sixth year. So I didn't do my leaving. There was a lot of, I suppose at that time, impulsive behaviours. So not thinking through things through, got in a boat, went to London, with, I think, about 20 pounds in my pocket, got a job as a live-in barmaid. And because you could do things like that. Like there was, I was always very resourceful. I was never without working or without being independent, but I was not doing what my peers were doing at all. I was like on a completely different planet, but that planet was running parallel with where my friends were. So, you know, in hindsight, Claire, I can look back and go, oh, that was my ADHD. That was my ADHD. I never looked at another part of neurodiversity that I ended up realizing 18 months ago that I have as well, which is autism. And again, that was interesting because when I got the autism diagnosis, I was like, oh, no, I'm not. No. I'm not comfortable with that. Because again, that perception of what we think autism is, you know, it's nonverbal, it's a lot of stiming, which is, and I do talk with my hands a lot, but it's using, whether it's flicking your foot or shaking your hands as a form of calming yourself down. It's actually not because people are spiraling, it's the opposite. But it took me, so it took me a little while to kind of come to terms with that one and go, oh, okay. Once I started to delve into it and understand it and realize, oh, that makes complete sense, utter sense. So even though I've achieved a lot in my life to date, I've probably made it as hard as possible because I didn't understand who I was.
And what led you to make those appointments in the first place to get these diagnoses?
So my eldest, I have two boys. I call our house the House of Tism, which is because I even think one of my dogs doesn't like the sound of the local kids' school when the kids are out playing in the yard. It's really funny. It's a new thing she's just started. So I have two boys. One will be 19 in a month, just done his leaving. The other one is 17, just started in sixth year. The younger son would be very much more like me. I would never, ever have said he was neurodiverse. But my older son was diagnosed when he was about 7 or 8. And I still hadn't got my head around his diagnosis. He was diagnosed autism. I totally pushed back because I was like, no, he's not. He's just hyper. He's very dogmatic. But it's the black and white thinking that comes with autism. And in fifth year for him, so a year and a half ago, when I was going, okay, we really need to put our head down and try and figure out a plan here for sixth year, he was like, you don't understand. You're not ADHD. So there was a huge divide between us. And because I'd always had that feeling that that's my ADHD, I only went purely to get a piece of paper so I could say, there it is. I can now help you. So there was nothing more. I was not on some magical journey of I'm going to get myself understand who I am. But that's what transpired. And it has been the most fascinating 18, 19, 20 months of my life, I would say.
And that's as a psychotherapist. And you have gone deep into the understanding of self, the mind, how all that works. So I just think it's worth saying that you already had a very deep understanding. And this obviously brought you that bit deeper. Is there any sense of anger, grief, disappointment that you didn't know this earlier, or how could things be different? Do you have to navigate a little bit of that?
Absolutely. I think one of the things what I've learned, because I ended up working for about a year, 2 days a week for a psychiatrist, doing initial intake. So not diagnosing or anything, just sitting with adults who were coming in. And rather than when you go for this is a very long-winded answer to your question, but if when you go to see a psychiatrist, there's a lot of box ticking, very little conversation of stories that you may, as an adult, want to say, you know, and then I was really bad with relationships, or in school, I felt very isolated. It's just because there's no box for that. So it's just tick, tick, tick. And what I had suggested to the psychiatrist is, there is a space where we actually need to hear, because if you're an adult going for a diagnosis, unlike children who aren't coming with their stories, you're coming because you're trying to fix something or to get an understanding of what's been going on in your life. And it's not cheap to go privately. So I would sit with these adults doing their intakes and going through questions and questions and literally hearing their stories and writing it all down so I could have that understanding and connect the dots. And I think for me, what it did, it allowed me to let go of my anger of why didn't somebody realize? For example, I am, my father is South African Indian, my mother is Irish. As a kid, I was what, this is the narrative that would have been said at home, I was double jointed. So I could lie on the floor and touch my toes to my head. I could flick my fingers back to my hand, like silly things. But that's actually hypermobility. Hypermobility is a huge factor within neurodiversity. So rather than anybody saying, oh, maybe we should look at this, like she's very hyper, she's got hypermobility, it was, sure, Indians are very mobile because they do lots of yoga. You know, and that I understand now, that was just the times we lived in. It was easier to find other narratives rather than question what was actually going on. Food sensitivities. So listening to all of these people, men and women, but primarily women, because that's my real big interest, is to hear their stories allowed me, I think, to have greater forgiveness for the anger that I had, because really, if I'd been diagnosed when I was younger, then I wouldn't be where I am now and learning the way I'm learning, which is, for me, I think it's the right way.
Yeah, I mean, there's no point in us saying what could have or should have been. Yeah. Everything happens and leads you to who you are today. But I'm sure it takes a little bit of recalibration because you're looking back on things with a different lens. But as you said, you always had a sort of a wondering, an inkling perhaps, and it confirmed some of the things perhaps, especially with the ADHD.
Yeah.
So everybody, or there is nobody immune to burnout,
no.
But are you more likely to burn out if you're neurodivergent because you're trying to conform to perhaps ways that don't necessarily suit your way of thinking?
Yeah, and I think if you look at you got diagnosed, misdiagnosed, undiagnosed. You can put adults into those sort of three categories. So you may have somebody who's undiagnosed or misdiagnosed, and they're trying really hard to conform and work and live in society as it is. I've come into studio today to talk to you, and here outside the studio is all open plan with big strip lighting. And I've been sitting for a couple of minutes and going, oh my God, how did I do this? Because I worked in similar situations. I could not come in here every single day and work within that open plan setting with all that noise distraction around me, with that level of intense, very harsh lighting. And I was observing people and it wasn't bothering them because they just come in and they do their job. Whereas when you have a neurodiverse person, those things are going to, they've got that added layer that they have to deal with all the noise, they have to deal with the distractions, the lighting, the environment. It's actually very warm. Overheating or heat dysregulation is a huge factor. We haven't even started trying to do our job. Like we've literally just walked into the building and you have all of that going on. You know, there is so many additional factors that, I mean, I could sit here for weeks talking to you, but even things like rejection sensitivity. I'd never even heard of what rejection sensitivity was. And initially it was like, oh, well, so I'm feeling bad when a boyfriend breaks up with me. Well, that can be a very big impact on us, even if we wanted to break up. But if you have a line manager or a colleague who is saying something that, about your work that, and it can be constructive, it's not about somebody slandering your work, that, you know, maybe you could do it this way. Instead of hearing the words, maybe you could do it this way, what I've internalized is, I've been found out, I'm not good enough. They don't like me. They don't like the way I do my job. I've gone off on a completely different narrative because I now think you don't like me. So it's not, you've actually just said, could you try and do this a different way? I've gone off on a tangent. That's exhausting. That emotional impact that I have and the narrative I've created with no facts are emotionally draining, which can lead to burnout.
So what's your advice to people then based on what you know? I must say through my work, particularly with health and wellbeing seminars, I know we've done a couple together with a company called Spectrum who are going into corporates and providing a health and wellbeing program. And there is so much more conversation about creating an atmosphere where people can say, this is how I prefer to work. How can we make this happen? And, you know, you don't have to necessarily talk about your neurodivergence. It's just who you are and how you like to work so that you can thrive. So I do think the change is coming. I do think there are changes within the classroom setting. I do think we have a way to go. But do you feel positive that things are feeling better? And do you recommend people speak up?
I sit in the fence on this. I think schools have a long way to go. I think there is still that belief that, that maybe, as I sort of refer to it, the 1980s belief that if a child is being disruptive, that's what they're being, instead of maybe looking at why they're being disruptive rather than punishing them, figuring out what's going on, and then how can we talk to this person and this young adult. If we're looking in secondary schools, and I think secondary schools are very much still need, they know, but, and I will say, I know there are, a lot of them are under-resourced. I still think we need to realise neurodiversity is a spectrum in itself. When we think of it, we kind of think of special schools or that there are special supports. We're just looking about an understanding within the classroom, not having special classrooms within the school. That's where we're jumping up a level. We're talking, I can say for my son, and I'm not going to say at school, the amount of his peers who are all strong, healthy, brilliant, bright kids who ended up going using getting DARE points because they fall within the neurodiversity spectrum. I've never seen this amount before. It because it's we're now that awareness is coming. They're getting their diagnosis in fifth and sixth year, not when they were in primary school. So, but there's always been that missing gap. And now, because the conversations like this, you bringing awareness, there could be parents listening to this going, oh, I never thought of that. Maybe I will get my kid checked. And it's not about labels, Claire. It isn't. It's about being able to understand, or giving young people or adults the power to understand who you are, not what you are. Because when we know who we are, we can then navigate. I can then say to you, Claire, I can't sit out there. That's way too bright in that office. Can we go into a smaller room? Not, I'm not being rude, but you go, oh, okay, you know, well, let's find somewhere else. But if I don't know it, I'm sitting there shaking in this bright room with lights. That's all we want to do, is empower people to be able to communicate what's going on. It's not about labeling. It's not about putting people into a corner because, you know, somebody who may be neurodiverse, somebody else might have a different issue. They might have gut health issues. You know, we don't need to all go around talking about it, but we need to be able to be psychologically safe wherever we are to say this environment isn't working for me.
Well, if you want to find out more about Siobhan's work, you can go to twistingthejar.com. She's also on Instagram at twistingthejar. Siobhan Murray, psychotherapist, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much.
Alive and kicking on News Talk.
Now, Don't Forget to Remember follows the Irish street artist Asbestos as he and his family learn to navigate his mother's diagnosis of Alzheimer's and cope with her fading memories. The film is at once a moving portrait of one woman's memory loss, but also a celebration of a family coming together in the face of this condition. The film features Helena and her husband, Matt, and Matt joins me in studio now. Matt, you are very welcome.
Thank you.
And we did meet at the screening in Dublin. And I want to, in a way, apologise because I think because my own dad had Alzheimer's and has since passed, and Ross Killeen, the director, his mom had Alzheimer's and had since passed. For some reason, I didn't realise until I watched the film that we were talking about somebody, Helena, who is still living with Alzheimer's.
Correct, yes, yeah, absolutely, yeah.
And you had Helena with you. So my brain took a while to catch up. So I'm saying hello to Helena. And I'm wondering, is this the sister-in-law? I mean, who is this person? And I suppose it became apparent that I recognised some sort of signs of Alzheimer's that I may have seen in my dad.
Correct, yeah.
And there can be an uncomfortableness there. And obviously it was a very busy, you know, cinema. There were a lot of people around gathering before we went in to watch the film. So I could see Helena was a little confused as to where she was. And I sort of, myself and my mum, we said a quick hello to you. It was hard for us all to hear each other. And then we kind of left you be to settle in. And I kind of felt bad about that afterwards, Matt, because that can happen sometimes. Somebody with Alzheimer's can become invisible and their carer because of that uncomfortableness.
Well, they do. When you say uncomfortable, you're right in that assessment, because the majority of people, when you do meet with them and they say hello to Helena and they kind of look at her and say kind of, well, how are things? And I say, well, she has Alzheimer's, you know. And then the first question they ask is, well, does she know who you are? And I said, of course they know who she is. She knows who I am. I mean, she has Alzheimer's. And this is not, this is a disease that a lot of, the perception basically is with people, when they watch TV programs and so forth, Alzheimer's is portrayed as at the advanced stages, not at the stage that Helena's at. Okay, she has it now. It's nearly 6 years at this stage. She's very, very calm in herself. Her short-term memory is gone. She gets very confused. But in essence, she's very, very calm, which is a big, big help to me. And in that case, when I meet with people, they don't actually see this as Alzheimer's. And then they don't have a conversation about it. I've passed a remark as well too about, you know, if somebody had cancer, they'll talk to you and say, well, what treatment is she getting? Is she getting chemotherapy? And what type of cancer she has. When we mention Alzheimer's, conversations kind of lapse.
And I did feel that, because I could sort of see you then from across the room, and the two of you were sort of standing alone. Now, only for a minute, you know, obviously your son was there. There was, you know, people you'd worked with on the film. I'm not suggesting you weren't being looked after. But do you ever feel that way a little invisible because people stand back a little?
I do, yes. I suppose it's when you say invisible, it's, I think people are very nervous and they're anxious about Alzheimer's. People don't talk enough about it. It's to a lot of people, it's a new disease. But I mean, it's a disease has been there for so many years. And progressively, it's debilitating as well, too. I look at Helena because she's a very intelligent woman, or was a very intelligent woman, and very astute as well, too. She's now not that person. She's not the person, basically, that I knew many years ago, but she is still the love of my life.
I love that, and I loved the film. Can you tell me about the discussion around the film when your son, Peter Asbestos, came to you with the idea? Did you have any hesitation in letting the cameras into your life?
I did. I had reservations about it. I mean, you were going into into the privacy, basically, of our home. But then when I spoke to Peter Asbestos about it, I said, well, you know, over the last year or two, because it's 4 years, 5 years since she was actually diagnosed, I said at this stage, I said, I feel people need to know about this. And if we can do this documentary and have it screened and let people see basically what dementia and what Alzheimer's is about, and that these people are not at the advanced stages. In the early stages, as I said to you earlier on, they're still calm. They're still able to communicate. Okay, not in the way that you and I would communicate. What I say to people, I can talk to Helena, but I can't have a conversation with her because there's nothing coming back. And also when she asks a question, halfway through the question, she can't remember what she's asking. But then I just changed the subject, or in some cases I would anticipate what she was going to ask, and that calms her down as well too. A lot of other people with Alzheimer's do get agitated when they can't get the question out, and to get frustrated as well too. Doesn't happen with Helena. That's a big help from my point of view, so it is.
Tell us a little bit about Helena. As you said, she's the love of your life, the mother of your two sons. When did this journey begin? When did you start to see signs that eventually led to the diagnosis?
Well, I saw signs way back. It's nearly 6 years ago now at this stage. You know, where's my keys? Where's my glasses? Certain things like that. Where are we going? Why are we going? And I got anxious about it, so I spoke to my GP. And as it transpired, the doctor actually was in the clinic with our GP. Dr. Rutledge is his name, but it was a Suzanne Walsh. And she said, kind of, well, we do this test. It's an MCA. They call it the MCA test, Montreal Cognitive Assessment, where they ask questions about certain things and they give points basically to it. And she said, yeah, there is something here, but let's review it in maybe 3 or 4 months' time. When she reviewed it in 3 or 4 months' time, she had declined at that stage in the test. So she said, yes, she has Alzheimer's, but we need to define it a lot more. So eventually we basically went to a Professor Dermot Power, who specialises in this, and he confirmed that she did have Alzheimer's.
How did Helena take that news?
Well, I suppose I never really said to her that she had Alzheimer's. She had a problem going way, way back where a brother of mine basically passed away and we were there actually when it happened. He had an accident. And she felt at that stage kind of that this has affected her memory, has affected her. She never recovered from it. So I went down that line, so I did, and didn't actually say that she had Alzheimer's, you know.
And how is she today?
Today, she's very, very, as I say, she's very, very calm. But her short-term memory is gone. She gets very confused. If I'm going somewhere, she's asking basically, where are we going? But she doesn't know what time is. If I said we're going in 2 hours' time, in 5 minutes later, she'll arrive in basically with her coat on her. Are we going? But she's calm, which is a big help from my point of view in actually looking after her. The days are very, very long. There's no two ways about it. It is tough. It's tough going. But I just, as I say, roll up my sleeves and just continue on with it because she's the love of my life.
And it is as much your story as it is Helena's, as it is the story of memory and the other members of your family. But that was something that really jumped out at me in the film based on my own family's experience. Mm-hmm. The idea that you can talk to Helena, but you can't have a conversation with her, that you're essentially missing the person you knew while they're sitting in front of you.
Very, very much so. Very, very much so, yeah. And I suppose even looking at the documentary in the film, I mean, there was snippets when we were actually on holidays in Italy and in America. And that really caught me because that was the person that I knew as my wife.
And the documentary, and I don't want to give away too many pieces of it because I really want to urge people to go see it, be you going through Alzheimer's or not, because it really focuses around memory and how much our memories make up the person that we are and how important they are to remember. And I do think that's a really important part. Those memories that we have, to hold them dear.
Well, actually, memories, I have loads of memories. And as the title says, don't forget to remember. I don't forget these memories. And they're there, and I'm never going to lose those memories. There are memories that I have over the last 50 years, 54 years, actually. We were married in 1970. And all those memories are still there. And that's why I say you don't forget your memories. And that's actually what keeps me going as well, too.
Now, you do say in the film about your working life, about working in the pub trade. Mm. They're long hours. That's a huge commitment. And that Helena worked alongside you for much of the time. But that there were family moments that you missed out on. And your son, Peter Asbestos, says, you know, there was times as he got older, he pulled away from, you know, his mom, and there were conversations that he now wishes he had. Mm-hmm. How do you feel about regret? Do you have regrets now you're in this chapter?
So in some ways I have regrets, but, you know, in essence, when you work I mean, I was the type of individual kind of that I took on a job, I took on a responsibility. I felt it was my responsibility then to go through with that. And I was working for my wife, for Helena, and for Billy, and for Pete, for my two sons. And, okay, I look back at times and say kind of, well, I could have done different from a family point of view. But I think Peter, to a certain extent, regrets kind of that he cannot have the conversations now that he would have liked to have had with her. But that's gone and that can't return. And he regrets that in some ways. I regret on his behalf as well, because I was that much closer to Alina than... I wouldn't say that my two sons were there. They're very close. They were actually very friendly. She was a friend as well as a mother.
Yeah, and I mean, it's a very natural part that we all move out of home. We set up our own life, our own friendship circles, our own family. So that is a very natural progression. Mm-hmm. He also asks an important question in it, and it's not necessarily about Helena, but when somebody loses their memories, are they still that same person? And it's something that I really thought about with my own dad. Mm. And as I watched the man that I knew slip away, I still felt he always had his essence. And do you feel that way about Helena?
I do. I do at certain times. There's nuggets that come back when suddenly I say, oh, where did that come from? And that was her. And that's a big help to me, to say that she's not completely gone. And, you know, she's still there as a person. And as I said, the memories basically pull that back as well too. And as I said, there are times she'll come up with something, she'll say something, which is totally out of context, and something that happened in the past. And I say, well, that's her, she's still here.
Matt, people will hear the emotion in your voice. It's obviously not an easy thing to go through. I was happy to see your story represented, because it's not easy to be somebody's carer.
Well, it's not. I mean, in the Alzheimer's Society, I mean, they're fantastic and a great help as well too. The lady that I deal with, Anya Bennett, is in my area. And what she says, and what most of them say, is it's not the person, it's basically the carer that needs to be looked after. I don't see it that way. I see it to a certain extent, yes, because I'm the person that's living it. I know what's happening to her. I know what way to react to a certain extent. She's calm. She's happy in herself. I don't know whether I don't know what's going through her mind in that regard, but she doesn't suffer the way that I do and that Billy does and Peter does.
And you do take some time away in one piece, and you say you feel guilty if you drop her, you know, off for a bit of respite. But were you happy to see her being filmed in respite? Because she actually looked really, really happy there. And obviously you came back recharged, and that's important for you and for her too.
Well, that's daycare. It's only, like, she goes in at 10:30 and she finishes at 3:30 and she goes through the events that are actually there, which she enjoys to a certain extent. In the beginning, she was very reluctant to go. She didn't want to go. But you're right, it does give me the extra couple of hours basically to sit down, relax, or go for a walk, meet with somebody. It's a big, big help, so it is. And as I say, I've said time and time again about the Alzheimer's Society's, the Carers Association as well too. They're out there. You have to ask for the help. The help is there. And it's fantastic to help us there.
Yeah, I did find the Alzheimer's Society of Ireland incredible as well. And finally, how did you feel watching the film for the first time?
Not great. I felt, as I said, the part of it really was going back when it showed her, basically, when we were in Italy and that, in Rome. I was looking at the person that I knew for so many years that has now changed. That is not the person that is with me today. It was tough, very, very tough, I must say.
Well, you're doing an incredible job. Take care of yourself too. It's such a moving film. I urge everybody to go and see this film. It is called Don't Forget to Remember. You can find out where it is screening at don'tforgettorememberfilm.com. Matt, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you, Claire.
I really can't recommend the film enough. It is called Don't Forget to Remember. It is released in a number of cinemas up and down the country, so it's well worth checking out where there is one near you and trying to get to see it. Now, that's it for Alive and Kicking for this week. My thanks to my producer, Aidan McKelvey, and to Hugo Da Silva Scott, who was on sound. And thanks to you for listening. I will see you next week.
Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna. Sunday morning at 8 on News Talk.